I haven't made a controversial statement other than use the word fart in church for a long time. So I feel I need to get it out of my system. A controversial statement, and if it offends you, good. If it doesn't, well, people send hate mail for it. Yeah, you can send it to whoever cares. I don't know. But the statement is this, and I know it's going to be extremely controversial. My wife, just when I said use the word controversial, I could feel how Marianne started praying at home. You know, but that's fair. That's fine. Statement is this: I don't believe the most oppressed ethnic people group in the world is an ethnic group. I don't believe that for one second. I think the most oppressed people group in the world are women. No matter how you would measure whether there's discrimination or oppression of ethnic groups, whichever way you want to measure it, if you take those groups and you go all the way down to the most oppressed ethnic group in the world, irrespective of its race, its origin, if you take that instance and you divide between men and women, guess what happens? The women are still more oppressed. They're still more exploited. They're still the second-class citizens, if you like, even in that ethnic group. And this is not the opinion of the church. This is not the opinion of our sponsors. This is just Jacques' opinion, that the most oppressed people group on the planet is women. And as the church, what we should be doing is, in my mind, is we should be empowering women, we should be addressing this, we should teach men how to be men, you know, to treat women, to raise them up. That's part of what we are called to do. And Women's Month is nice, you know, good, but I don't know how we will do it, but we'll actually have to do something practically to start addressing this. The fact that even in South Africa, with all our diverse everything that's going on, women are still, if you compare men to women, there is a difference. And it's our job to do something about that. And I don't know what that is, but I know that's the direction we should be heading in. Because all through scriptures, what you find is that it's this thing between men and women. For instance, Esther's story is a story of romanticized oppression. Romanticized. Just think about this. It starts with King Vashti. I hope I pronounced that correct. Beautiful woman. Looks like my wife. Okay? So she's apparently so beautiful that the king wants to show off with her. And he had a six-month-long party, and after a week of drinking, imagine how your friends would look after a week of drinking, you know? I don't know how they would look, but anyway, the king decides, Sean, you're smiling in a very suspicious way. I don't know why you're smiling like that. Just concerns my heart, you know? Anyway, but anyway, so they bring, the king says, okay, here's what we need to do. I want to show you off my prized possession, my queen. And she just refuses to be paraded in front of a bunch of drunk men. So the king gets all his counselors together, and you must go and read this. So that woman in the kingdom of Persia would listen to their husbands and not rebel and talk back, they decided to exile Vashti. Just like that. So the king Xerxes goes on a four-year battle against Greece. He's got a horrible time. The Greeks kick his bum. Comes back, gets home, and he's not a happy camper because all of a sudden he realizes, I don't have a queen anymore. I've got a harem full of women, but I don't have a queen. So on the advice of some of his counselors, they round up like cattle all the beautiful virgins in the country, bring them together, put them through a year of perfume and beauty treatments and whatever you women do when you make yourself beautiful. We just enjoy the end product as men. But they go through this process. And then, as the woman, you get one night with a king. Just one night. And he goes through all these virgins, all of them. And if you're the lucky one that gets picked, ta-da, you're queen. You know, that's how it works. So Esther goes into this place, but her cousin Mordecai tells her, listen, you cannot tell anybody you're a Jew. Don't tell anybody you're a Jew. So she's for a year being perfumed and buttered and creamed and whatever, you know, those things, taught how to speak to the king. And then eventually it's her night to go in with the king, and she gets selected as the queen, which is, in my mind, just a very weird system, but this is how the story goes. And she had to fight with her conscience for a year, because she's a Jew, but she lives in a heathen, in a Persian harem, where, you know, it's different foods, different customs, all those things. So for a year, she cannot tell people, but listen, I'm actually a Jew. Her cousin, meanwhile, outside the palace, he is a typical Jew. He is the poster child of Jew. The way I've met a couple of Jews, gotten to know a couple of them, and this guy fits the bill. Mordecai has held a sort of low-level administrative position. So the fact that you read in the Bible, they say, well, he sat at the gates. Now, the gates was like our legislature, you know, where the laws get made, administrative decisions are made, those type of things. So the fact that Mordecai could sit there meant that he had some kind of position. And the king decided, he's going to appoint a second in charge, a guy called Haman, or how the Arabs would have pronounced it, Haman. Haman. So Haman gets appointed. And he enjoys this idea that when he rides on his horse, people bow down. But guess who doesn't? Mordecai the Jew, because the Jews don't bow before anybody. That's not our style. We only bow before God. So every time Haman would come past, everybody would bow, Mordecai would stand up. And Haman gets very upset about it, but he keeps his pose. You know, it's like the men would know. When your wife gets angry and you ask her what's wrong, and she says nothing, then you know it's something, but she says nothing. But you get, there's a disconnect between, there's a message that I'm getting, but what she's saying is two different things. Now, that's what happened. So Haman keeps his pose. But it bothers him to the point that he grows in his offendedness to such a point that he goes to King Xerxes and he offers him, out of his own bank account, 500 million rands worth of silver. For a order, for a declaration. Kill the Jews. One day. Make them a free-for-all. One day, we just, you know, it's like you wake up the morning, they're Jews, you go to bed that evening, no more Jews. That's what he's proposing. 500 million. And the king says, why? And he says, yeah, well, you know these Jews, their customs are contrary to ours. So let's just get rid of them. So the king goes like, okay, just make sure the money's in the bank. Pays it over, signs the order, and the two of them go and have a lunch. Decide the extermination of a whole people group and have lunch. That's how they do it. That's how they roll. So what happens is, and this is where the Jewishness of Mordecai comes in, because he hears about this, and he puts up a show. Baby, he goes to office, and he wails, he cries. Sackcloth and ashes, sitting at the gates. And the people try and keep him quiet. But this guy, he tears his clothes. He's crying. It's a massive scene that he throws there. And he throws such a scene that eventually Esther hears about this. She sends a messenger to him and says, dude, here's some clothes. Hey, have some food. Do something. Just stop making a mess. And it's there where you would know this famous statement. It's a famous, famous statement where he sends through to her, back through the messenger, where he says to her, Esther, don't think for one moment because you live in the palace that this trouble is not going to find you there. If it's not through you, salvation will come through someone else. But maybe you were brought into the kingdom, put in the position as queen for a time such as this. You remember that? Yeah, so there's this where Haman comes and Mordecai comes and he challenges her. He says to her, Esther, do not make this about yourself. You think you're going to be all right, but do not make this about yourself. And the passage of scripture that we read just now, is now what follows next, because that's where we're going to focus. We're going to focus because what she did was this. She listened to her cousin's challenge. Say, hey, don't make this about yourself. It's not about you. This is about something more, greater than just you. You think you're going to be all right? You're not going to be all right. This thing is coming for all of us. And so when she hears this challenge and she decides to take up this challenge, she asked the Jews with her maidservants to pray and fast with her for 3 days. Because you see, what she did then, the moment she took up that challenge, it required her to live courageously. It required her to live courageously. Now, we look at you. You're a bunch of informal people. None of you are wearing ties. Not even the woman. I'm wearing a scarf, me and Michelle. And Belinda, we're wearing scarves. This is my idea of a tie. But the thing is we're an informal bunch of people. So we don't really have got a grit for protocol. But if you and I were to pop over, or we can't fly to England, but if we were to walk over to England and get to Buckingham Palace, it's not like we're just going to walk in and go to the Queen and say, hey, how is it, Beth? Let's have a sit down. Let's have some tea, you know, or Liz, whatever you want to call her. It's not going to happen. There are protocols. You have to make appointments, and they see whether you're important enough to waste the Queen's time. You know, those type of things. This is a whole process. Now, take that idea, which most of us would understand, put it on steroids, and you get where this king lived. Because if you were close to the king, Xerxes, and you didn't have an appointment, or you appeared without having a very clear reason to be there, guess what happened? You got relieved of your head. You know, sort of like, no, this thing obviously not working, because if you were thinking, you would not have done this. So let's take it off. You know, that's the thinking there. So it was a real risk. So she fasts and prays for 3 days. And then what she does is she goes and she stands after 3 days, dresses up, does the butter, does the cream, what women do, and she stands just in line of sight of the king. Now, the risk was, if he didn't extend his scepter to her, guess what? Head off. That's it. Finish. End of game. Esther just goes to chapter 4. That's it. Doesn't go to chapter 9. You know, but the king sees her, he smiles, and he hasn't seen her for a month. So he extends the scepter, and she comes in. And what follows is a series of baby steps. First saying to the king, King, I would love for you and Haman to come and have supper with me. And the king knows. He knows something is up. So he comes to the first supper. What's supposed to happen? No. Come again tomorrow night. Goes the following night, drinks some wine. That was before the lockdown, a couple of thousand years before the lockdown. But they drink some wine, and then eventually she gets the opportunity to reveal to the king, I'm also a Jew. And I'm asking for the life of my people and for my own life. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see the applications of this story to where we live practically. Think about South Africa, where we are at this point in time. The challenge of Mordecai is exactly the same to Esther and to us. Because his challenge, in essence, is, hey, don't make this about yourself. This is not about you. There's something greater than you here. And if you think you're going to be all right, guess what? The trouble that you think is going to happen out there, it's going to come knocking on your door. We need people to live courageously. Right? And that is true. That is true. That is true for South Africa. But it's not actually where I want to focus. Because I want to propose to you, before we're going to slay a giant, we need to slay a lion and a bear. Because we've all, each one of you, well, I know most of you, a lot of visitors here today, but most of you, I know, just like me, have areas in your life that requires courageous living. We do. It might be, you know, the slow drift of a relationship. Anyone who's been married for more than 2 years know what I'm talking about. That where you wake up one day and you went like, huh? Who are you again? And how did this distance come here? Or it might be a habit that you started forming slowly over time. You know, it started off, and now when you tell people about your habit, it's like, you know. Or it might be you started off when you got your job the first time. You remember how excited you were and how amazing it is. Oh, and now you're just wasting oxygen and taking up space. We all have got these areas in our lives. Whatever your area might be, we all got areas where we need courageous living, where we have to stand up and actually take a risk. Now, the reason or the way how you recognize your area is your natural sense of apprehension. So as I'm talking here now and I say to you, hey, you've got areas that require courageous living, you will probably go like, I wonder what he's talking about. Just think about the areas where you think to, hell no, I don't want to go there. And you can write 2 pages of excuses why you shouldn't go there. You know, it's not my fault. It wasn't my fault. It's not my responsibility. It's not even close to my responsibility. Why should I be the one? And then again, even if I spent all this time and this money and this effort and this whatever I want to spend in this, you know, have you met that idiot? You know, it's not going to work anyway. It's just going to be a waste. You know what I'm talking about? That list that you can come up. But when you take that list and you distill it down, it comes to this one place where it says, fear. We're afraid. I'm afraid to do something because I'm not sure about the outcome. I'm not sure whether this thing is going to work out the way that I think it should work out. I want a sure thing. And then Belinda will tell you there are only 2 sure things in life, death and taxes. Yes. And that's what happens. But we want the sure thing. And until we can get the sure thing, what we do is we steer away from those areas. And people will ask us about it, and we'll say, yes, but I pray about it. I'm praying about it. Yeah? Ever done that? Hidden behind prayer? Just not to do anything? Okay, it's just me. Okay, well, this goes out into the world. Anyway, you holy liars, I can see you. Yeah, that's what we do. We don't want to do something, so what do we do? No, I'm praying. And we pray whatever prayers we pray. Because we don't want to do action. But the most amazing thing for me is I love this definition. Definition of courage. It's fear that said its prayers. And this is what Esther did. Esther was required to take some risk. And what she did was she went to God first, and she prayed. And from that position of prayer, she acted. Now, just like the Bible tells you, faith without works is dead, prayer without an action is useless. Prayer must flow out into an action. If it doesn't flow out in an action, guess what you've been doing? You've not been living courageously. Because what happens is, it's like the walls of Jericho. So yesterday morning, preparing for today, and yesterday morning somebody says, you know what, it's like the walls of Jericho. They're like, he says, they were walking around the city for 7 days, and the last day 7 times around. But they did this because God told them to. This is what I want you to do. So from that listening relationship with God, that hearing relationship, outflowed, you know, this walking around. Then when they blew the trumpets and the walls came down, guess what they still had to go and do? They still had to go and conquer the city. It's not like the walls fell down and, now we've got the city. Let's go home, boys. Lunch. That was not what happened. They still had to go and conquer Jericho. The same idea is there. You and I can pray. But after the prayer, at some stage, there must be that step. There must be that step where you take out that step and you live courageously. Now, the problem that you and I have is that most of the time when it comes to that, we think about prayer as a checklist. You know, we just tick, 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 tick. That's That's how we go through prayer. But I've been challenging you over the last couple of weeks to think about prayer, not as just asking a bunch of stuff, but think about prayer as walking in the garden, like Adam and Eve. Just wear clothes, okay? Please. But walking in the garden with God, wrestling with God, discussing with God, because you see this in Esther's story. She needed to tell the king, "Your Majesty, I'm a Jew." But she couldn't do it the first time. Couldn't do it the second time. It was only at the second supper with some wine that she knew, okay, now I can do that. It was a baby step. It was not like she went like, "Well, here's the plan, how to save the nation. What we're going to do is we're going to stand in the line of sight. We're going to have two suppers. Around about 7:15, the king will be drunk, and then I'll ask him my question." It wasn't like that. It was a feel, walking it out. But if you get that, if that makes sense to you, then what you will hear is courageous living has got a sense of, I lean into it. I'm not trying to avoid heart. I'm not trying to avoid those areas of apprehension, those areas where I actually want to, it's just easier to leave it. But you lean into it and you soak it with prayer. Where you're like, "Lord, I know this is an area. I know this is an area of that I need to live courageously, but I'm just not there." And you're leaning into it. You're leaning into it, leaning into it. And then you begin to act as God leads you in that place. We need people who live courageously. Now, in South Africa, more than ever, we need people. And this is my prayer. This is for the church, for our church, for our city, for our country. If we will be extremely foolish and idiotic if we continue making it just about ourselves and not hearing the words of Mordecai. We will be so stupid that whatever the consequences would be, we've deserved them, we've earned them. But when I say that, I don't want you to storm out here and storm the municipal buildings or do something stupid, okay? Because the mayor is not there anymore. We're not sure who the mayor is. What I want you to do is to live courageously and fight your lion in your bear before we tackle this giant of the city and the giant of the country. You've got areas in your life that scares you, that makes you apprehensive, that makes you, "I don't want to go there. I want to challenge you." Don't make it about yourself. Soak those areas with prayer, but lean into them. They're not going to go away. That relationship is not going to heal itself. That habit is not going to break itself. Your job or your boss, not going to change itself. Lean into it. Don't try and avoid it. Is there risk involved? Yes. But that's why you and I have to pray and get into the presence of God so that the love of God brings us to a place where even when we face those risks, because we are so full of what He's said to us and His assurance and His love, that we'll go, okay. Well, if they relieve me of my head, going to Jesus. If they don't relieve me of my head, yay. Can't lose for winning. Does that make sense? Okay. So here's the prayer that I want to pray for you. And I'm not going to ask your permission. Just by virtue of being here, you're a free target. And by virtue of watching over the internet, you are a running target. So just know this. This is coming. I'm going to pray that God will show you the areas where you need to live courageously. It might be one of the examples that I've used, or it might be something totally different. Just before you get upset, just know, the guy sitting next to you, or the gal sitting next to you, now this is not the time, I could see you go, what is he going to say about you now? No, we all have got those areas. Make no mistake. We all have got those areas that we try and shy away from. But we have to live. Our call is to live courageously. So I'm going to pray that God will show you your areas. Can I do that? Look a little bit more excited. Thank you. Thank you. This is good for us. This is good. This is like gym. It's not always lekker, especially when you... Oh, did I tell you the one day I tried to show off and I tried to bench press and my right hand just gave out. Like, poof. I'm not sure why. And I'm lying with... I was trying to show off, but it wasn't even that much. But I was lying with 120 kgs on my chest. I go, oh, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And these two dudes come and stand, but these buff dudes, they come and they stand there in front of me. They go, do you need help? I go like, yes. This is what we're going to do now. We're going to say, Lord, we need help.